Attack of the Final Girls is a podcast about the horror genre, so listener discretion is advised. Please check the show notes for specific content warnings for this episode, and of course, beware of spoilers.
Hello again, and welcome to Attack of the Final Girls. I'm Teresa.
And I'm Juliet.
I almost said I'm Juliet. I don't know why.
I mean, I can be Teresa today.
I will never remember that. Identity politics are already hard enough. I don't know if I can. It's a Saturday morning. I don't know if I have the brain capacity to be able to, like, personify another person. I can barely personify myself. Please do not perceive me. Speaking of personification, I don't know. I was trying to, like, roll this into our movie today, and then I was like, no, I failed at that, too.
Well, you can't wear somebody else's face today.
Oh, Juliet had it. You've got much more brain juices flowing.
I mean, I drank a whole iced coffee very quickly. So
that's fair. I'm only halfway through my tea, so that's probably why. But speaking of identity politics, wearing other people's faces, et cetera, today we're covering Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Yes.
We jumped the first one.
We did.
If you've seen it, that's fine. If not, whatever. Also,
honestly, this is a sequel that you can drop into without having seen the first one. You will understand a few more of the little references if you have seen the first one, but really you could hop right into this one and understand the basics of what is going on. It is Texas. There are chainsaws and there is a massacre.
So I'll be just, like, totally upfront. I mentioned this at the end of the last episode. I understand what Texas Chainsaw Massacre means to the horror genre. I respect Tobe Hooper for making that film. I respect that it has inspired oodles of movies. I personally don't like the film, and I know that that is blasphemous to many horror fans, especially diehard fans of that movie. I get it. I don't like it. It's just not my favorite movie of all time. I didn't watch it as a kid, so I don't have any nostalgic ties to it. It was not my first horror movie. I did not see it until I was an adult who already had a horror movie podcast. So I was already kind of, like, critically thinking about movies at that point in time. So by the time I finally watched it, I was just kind of like, there's a lot of screaming. There's a lot of blood. It's pretty gory and violent. The story was really lacking for me. So I just am not a fan. All that to say, that's where I was coming into this movie from. I really do my best to give every movie the benefit of the doubt. And I just come into it with, like, an open mind, which I know that not everybody is capable of doing that either. But I'm just like, I'm here to have fun. And if I am entertained by a movie, then that gets a green check mark for me.
Yeah.
The first TCM did not do that for me. This one, however, knowing how I felt about the first one, I was like, no, I need to give it a weather try, because Bill Moseley's in this, Dennis Hopper's in this, and this is, like, primo Dennis Hopper crazy man era. You know, he's, like, getting wild in David Lynch movies, and in this movie, he's, like, triple wielding, you know, chainsaws. So I'm like, well, yeah, I'm going to watch this. And you had mentioned before that Stretch is a much better character than Sally. She's a much better final girl than Sally. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to give it a try. And I'm really glad that I did, because I think it is miles away better than the first one. That's my opinion. And I know that it's not a popular one.
I mean, I think that this film, at the time that it came out, confused a lot of people. In addition to coming off the heels of the original much, much later, this was coming off the heels of sort of a re-release or a revival of the original in theaters. And Tobe Hooper has said, and he has couched this with, maybe he's the only person on earth that thinks this, that the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre actually contains a lot more black comedy than people give it credit for. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because the shock value. And honestly, at some point, I am going to rewatch the original to see if I can, like, get behind what he's saying, to see if his intent as a filmmaker actually shines through. I see the parody aspect a little bit in the original, but I don't see the, like, straight up black comedy. So for this one, he really, really leaned in. And part of it was really complicated because he kind of had a different vision for this film when he started working on a sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He wanted to do something that was a little more, like, straight up parody of Motel Hell. And he and Canon Studios went kind of back and forth. And the studio, everybody was like, why do you want to do this black comedy thing? And he's like, no, the original was had black comedy elements. I want to lean into it. And they changed the script several times. One of the things that everybody says is that he just doggedly was like, I want this to be, although we really didn't have this phrase back then, a horror comedy. And that was just one of the things that he was really, really firm about. And so I think for fans at the time, coming off of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was so stark, so gritty, they really were leaning into the whole based on a true story thing. Mm-hmm. This was a hard, hard leap. That said, it has become a cult favorite. Like, mm-hmm. there are so many people, just like you, who have found this movie kind of separate from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, and are like, oh my God, this is great.
Yeah.
And you can also see this movie's influence. I mean, look at Rob Zombie. That's what I said when we were watching this. I said, watch this through the lens of how it inspired Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
And it's so clear. And he's not the only one, obviously, but it has inspired so many movies. We love Bill Moseley. Right. You know, it really brought Bill Moseley to the horror genre, which I'll talk a little bit more about how that happened later. It has become a beloved sequel that's finally now like starting to get its flowers.
Yeah. I mentioned this to Juliet while I was watching it. Now that I know that Motel Hell was actually a parody of the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then Tobe Hooper was like, I need to make a parody of Motel Hell, which I think is hilarious. It's like parodyception. I think that this movie is like Motel Hell meets Freaks, like the 90s movie Freaks with Randy Quaid, meets Pee-wee's Big Adventure, if it was directed by a Coen brother. If you watch like up to the point where there's the introduction of Leatherface and even some parts afterwards, it really kind of feels like a Coen brothers film.
Yeah.
It's got like that deadpan seriousness where like we know we're about to get something goofy, but all of the characters are very deadpan and serious about it. There's a little levity later on, but that's kind of how I feel. It's like this weird four-way mashup of like dark comedy. If you watch some of Tobe Hooper's other movies, like Poltergeist, for instance, I think that there's black comedy written all over.
Oh yeah.
Poltergeist especially. And he did some serious ones like Life Force, I think, is pretty serious. Mm-hmm. But then he went into doing like Tales from the Crypt, Body Bags, movies like that, which are very, very funny and also horrific and have like a lot of body horror in them, too. So this, I think, was exactly the amount of dark comedy sprinkled on top of sort of a crime thriller because of like the whole lefty character, mm-hmm. like sprinkled on top of this like Coen brothers, you know, dark like thriller, crime, mystery film almost with some goofy antics added in. Because if you didn't have Chop Top, this I think would be a much like darker film.
Absolutely. Yeah. Chop Top introduces an element of like Muppet-esque chaos that I just really, really appreciate.
Yeah. Because if you removed him, then all of the scenes with Stretch and Leatherface like kind of communicating, because mm-hmm. it's almost always bookended by Chop Top being a goofball.
Yeah.
And their dad, which I think in the credits they call him Cook.
Yeah.
They just call him Cook, even though his name is Dawson, I think.
Drayton. It's because he was Cook in the first one.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. He was a much less prominent character in the first one, but he is Cook in the first one. And I don't think that he is given the name Drayton until this one.
Okay. And then, you know, Chop Top is the hitchhiker's brother from mm-hmm. the original. But even still, like, even with those connections to the first film, you almost don't even need those.
Right.
Like, even if you didn't remember or you didn't know that there were connections to the family from the first one, you don't really need to. It's okay.
Yeah.
And I almost like that they don't beat you over the head with, like, remember this from the first movie? Mm-hmm. Remember this person from the first movie? Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because all of these characters really kind of, like, stand on their own. And they all live together. And this is ostensibly also in a different area of Texas.
Yes. Yeah.
So the events of the first one were in South Texas. And so now we're in Northern Texas, close mm-hmm. to the Oklahoma border. So it's kind of like, oh, we're safe. We're in North Texas. That doesn't have anything to do with us. And then you find out you're not safe because they're in North Texas now.
Yeah.
Some of them are in North Texas now. Yeah. So Juliet mentioned that there's all sorts of love for Sally. There's all sorts of love for Sally Hardesty in the first movie, being the OG, you know, scream mm-hmm. queen, final girl. It didn't do it for me because I'm not as much of a fan of like straight up brutal horror movies, mm-hmm. especially if the brutality is not with a really good storyline. Not to say I won't watch them. I just normally can't get behind them. So that's sort of what put me off from the original TCM. But Stretch is so much better of a character. Like, there's an actual story that's happening in this movie, and it's not just gal screaming mm-hmm. for an hour and a half.
I mentioned this. It's been quite a while. I'm pretty sure it was when we were on Horror Drafts mm-hmm. and we were drafting our like favorite final girls. I said, you know, it is a controversial opinion and like whatever, like Sally is an iconic final girl for good reason, you know, in a lot of respects, you know, debatable whether it was her or Janet Leigh or somebody even before them, you know, whether she's certainly like, well, again, that could be her, Janet Leigh, the first slasher scream queen. Like, I get it, but I love Stretch. I think Stretch is a far more interesting, compelling character. And to me, she embodies like what a really good final girl is, which is that she's not just surviving, but she's being strategic, you know, and she's using her wits to try to escape the killer and try to outsmart the killers in a way that I just don't see Sally doing it.
Oh, no, no. And part of that is like Sally is confronted with like this disgusting, like really terrible thing. And Stretch kind of has the jump on her because she knows what's been happening.
Right.
Like we get in the beginning roll up that this is something that's been happening for a while, that there are chainsaw murders that keep happening. So Stretch is aware of this, being a journalist and also a DJ. She's aware of these things happening. And then she has it happen on her show via the phone, via a car phone. She gets to hear like all of the terrible things that are happening to these two asshole kids in this car. So she sort of is primed, like yep. she's prepared ahead of time. Obviously she wasn't ready for them to like bust into her radio station, but she was at least armed with the knowledge that this is something that was a possibility. So she's kind of ahead of the game in terms of like between her and Sally. But I also respect that at certain points, Stretch is almost a social worker for,
I mean, almost, yeah.
For Leatherface.
Yeah.
Like, she's trying to communicate with him. She's trying to communicate ideas, obviously in her own self-interest because like she doesn't want to die, mm-hmm. which who does by chainsaw? But she almost works as like a social worker, trying to establish a line of communication, trying to understand like what Leatherface's motivations are, as disgusting as they might be. And I think that that's a really interesting dynamic that you don't often see, is like the final girl in a place where she gets to make space for communication between her and the slasher.
Absolutely. Have I told you about the first time I saw this?
I don't think so.
Okay, so I saw this as I believe the horror gods intended, but there's a funny twist to this because I actually, it was like almost too much. I saw this at Inglewood, one of our one screen theaters, pre-remodel, pre-reopening
oh,
in
God.
2007 on 35 millimeter.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, it was amazing. I am so grateful for that experience. It was also completely overwhelming. And I was like, do I like this? I don't even know. Like, that was chaotic. And I don't know if I like this. And that's then fair. I gave it another watch at home. And I was like, oh, yeah, I like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. And there's something really special about watching a movie on 35 millimeter as God intended. You
yeah.
know, I watched Smokey and the Bandit on 35 millimeter.
Nice.
At a, or whatever it is that they use at a drive-in, but it wasn't digital.
Right.
If it's 35
yeah.
millimeter at on the drive-in.
Film.
Yeah. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
And like quickly shot up to being one of my favorite movies of all time, specifically because of the environment
yeah.
of watching it, because there's just something special about a drive-in.
Yeah. The thing that really stuck out to me watching this the first time, like even when I was like, I don't know if I like the whole movie, and it was really chaotic and kind of overwhelming, was the opening sequence,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is like, despite people's opinions of this movie over the years, consistently makes it onto lists of like best opening sequences in a horror movie, because this movie does not fuck around.
No.
Like, it starts like 0 to 1,000 within the first like 3 minutes of the movie. Like, you are in it.
Yeah.
And it's a very iconic sequence with the car and Stretch listening to the call on the car phone, and you've got that great Oingo Boingo song playing.
Like, right.
That is an iconic horror moment.
Oh, absolutely. And we almost start to empathize with the killers because the two dudes in this Mercedes who are like
so terrible.
They're being dickheads on the radio phone, like on the request line. They're being assholes. They can't apparently, you know, disconnect the call unless the caller disconnects as well, because they'll just have dead air. And they fuck with people in the middle of nowhere in Texas, which, as a person with Appalachian roots, I will say, like, probably don't fuck with locals, and especially not in a place that you're not familiar with.
Yeah.
Be it in Texas or Kansas or West Virginia, wherever you are. Probably don't play chicken with dudes in an old school Chevy, like step truck. Like, that's not going to be a good plan for you.
Yeah.
In general, because even if they don't murder you with a chainsaw, which these two get murdered with a chainsaw, you might get shot. You might get run off the road. You're going to be, you know, in the middle of nowhere with no help. So, like, just don't do it.
I mean, not just in general, like, don't be an asshole in a place that you're visiting when you're an outsider.
That's a great point. Yeah. Just don't be an asshole in general. I mean,
yeah.
Visiting places, being just existing in real life, please don't be an asshole. But I enjoyed that quite a bit. Leatherface dancing on the hood of the car with a puppet in front of him with a chainsaw slicing up this Mercedes. Very satisfying.
Very, very satisfying.
It was a great opening scene. And then Stretch being helpless on the other side of the phone and not being able to stop hearing it, stop listening to it, you know, stop this thing that's happening to her. She just can't. And LG is over there dicking around with a bunch of cords and wires, which
poor LG.
I know. I love that too, though, the set design of the radio station and the fact that LG is just like pulling out random cords and like looking at them and then plugging them in random other places. I love that.
I have been in that position, so I know how that goes.
Yeah, it's just like, which cord do I pull? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And even though he did all that, it didn't matter. It was still happening.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how radio station phones work, but I thought it was cool that she couldn't hang up.
I mean, I think back in the day, it would be like a patch bay issue because it would be all manual. Like, they work a little differently now, like,
yeah,
with broadcast delays and things like that. But I mean, back in the 80s, they didn't have delays, you know, or anything like that. Like, live was live. Live was truly live. And I don't know how the phone systems would have worked back then. But it would be all manual patching. So maybe they would have it set that way where the caller has to hang up like for a very specific reason. And to disable that, you would have to like repatch the wires.
Oh, my God.
And if you're in like an old, you know, kind of a duct tape and spit radio station, which is what this looked like, you know, you may not know which cord is the cord to pull.
Yeah, so exactly.
I can see that happening.
And like, if I pull the cord or if I pull the wrong cord, like, how long are we going to be off the air?
Exactly.
Because it definitely seems like this is a situation where maybe not all that stuff is up to code. Like,
yeah,
it's a miracle that they broadcast.
It kind of seems that way.
You know, because remember, this is also a radio store gun shop. So, sorry, a radio station gun shop. So, so like, if the gun store like turns off their lights, then the radio stops broadcasting
it's
or something.
It's entirely possible.
I mean, I know that it's more complicated than that, but in this particular instance, it looks like it's a little bit of a random thing. Like if you get too close to it with a lawnmower or something, then the radio fuzzes out.
I mean, I could tell you stories about our old building, and I have heard stories about my station's original building, which I never got to broadcast from, that would lead you to believe that, yes, actually, that is the case.
Radio is sort of like a miracle anyways. I'm just it like, I don't know how it works, and I don't know how it doesn't give us cancer, but it's awesome. I don't know. I'm just like, it's magic. That's as much as I need to know.
Yeah.
There's like frequencies, and I mean, you can't see any of that. So to me, it's magic. If you put a person from the Middle Ages here now and you were like, listen, it's radio, it comes through the air, they'd be like, no, that's magic.
Yeah.
Burn the witch. Which is fine. I mean, I don't need to know how it works.
I mean, if that makes me like a professional sorceress as my job, I'm down.
Professional radio sorceress, yeah.
Sweet.
I mean, that I'm pretty sure that's what you need to put on your resume. If it doesn't already say that, professional radio sorceress.
I'm going to update my LinkedIn now.
Specialist music. Just like in parentheses.
Yeah.
I think that this has a really iconic soundtrack too.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's almost like a college station, at least what college stations were like at one point in time, although they're kind of closing, you know, closing down, unfortunately, but like Oingo Boingo, you had the cramps, which like you wouldn't hear the cramps on like,
yeah,
quote unquote, regular radio, not even in the 80s.
Well, I think it's important to remember that this is before the FCC ruling in 1996, the Communications Act of 1996, that started like really badly consolidating everything.
Oh.
And like making it so what was then Clear Channel and what is now iHeartMedia could own like the majority of stations in the country. Like that was not the case back in the day.
Right.
And like especially in the 70s and 80s, there were way more just like independent, like these little one-off radio stations that existed in local communities. A lot of them weren't even like public radio stations or like what we would know of now as like an LPFM, especially in places like Texas, where there are a lot of really spread out communities. You would have these like high powered, like little community owned commercial stations that were just local businesses that existed. Mm-hmm. And when 96 happened, there were a couple of things that preceded 96, but 96 was like the big, big turning point. When that happened, all of these stations got offers that they couldn't refuse from these giant monolith companies that then either put them out of business or made them into like mix stations, you know, like adult contemporary mix stations, and then subsequently sold them to Christian broadcasters, which is the problem we're having now. If you're interested in that, there's an excellent Rolling Stone piece that came out 2 months ago all about the pervasiveness of Christian broadcasters in this country.
Dang.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this definitely seems like one of those like kind of jack of all trades, master of none radio stations.
Oh, yeah.
Where like they're responsible for everything. And also those stretches like lives at this station. Because if you like look at the scene where she gets trapped in the, I guess you could call it the supply room. I'm just going to call it the ring room because there's a sign on the door that says ring. I don't know why there's no ring there, but or there's no doorbell or anything. But when she goes in there, there's tons and tons of food.
Yeah.
Which is so weird. Like, why would you have like a, you know, disaster shelter worth of food in there? But I think it's because she and LG basically have to live there. There's nobody else. Like,
oh, yeah.
We don't see anybody else who's running the station. We don't see. She's out also like simultaneously managing this radio station and being the primary DJ and also like being the one to go and report on other stories.
Oh, that's how it was back in the day.
So she basically, like, it's headcanon for me that she just lives there. Like, she and LG just live there and like sleep on the couch and drink Pepsis and stuff all day.
Oh, yeah.
That's all that they can do. And it's also in the middle of nowhere. She mentions the town a couple of times. I've never heard of this town before. It's apparently close to University of Oklahoma and University of Texas, because that's one of the things that they're mentioning at the beginning is the rivalry between the two. Mm-hmm. And that's why the two stupid idiots and the Mercedes are coming to town, is because they want to participate in this like goofy rivalry. But yeah, the set design of the radio station is awesome. It makes you feel cozy and comfy.
I loved it.
You're interested. You're like, I want to go flip through their record archives. Mm-hmm. You know, like I want to sit there and dick around on the typewriter. Like, it looks like fun. You know, they have like crazy posters. There's a ZZ Top record in the background. Mm-hmm. She's wearing a ZZ Top shirt at one point. It looks very homegrown and cool.
Well, and I love that they incorporated into the story not just the airing of the chainsaw death, but also like that scene where Chop Top shows up at the radio station is one of my favorite scenes, in part because it's like the thing, I think, you know, it's like a deep-seated fear of mine. Like that's probably the scariest part in the whole movie for me.
Yeah.
Is like somebody showing up, you know, like that late at night.
Well, luckily they wouldn't be able to get in.
It's true. Yeah. Security is much better in the modern era at media orgs.
Yeah.
We do lock our doors. But yeah, that scene was so scary to me. And yet so delightful in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, like, Chop Top is pretty dang rowdy. Let's just say that to be clear. But also, like, you can tell through all of his ramblings, he actually genuinely really likes the station.
Yeah.
You know? Like, and he's got that, like, creepy fan thing going on. And I just find that whole thing, like, really, really delightful that you even have this, like, villainous family. And Drayton says it later, you know, when he's berating Leatherface and Chopped Up, he's like, yeah, you guys just spend all day listening to the radio instead of doing your work or helping me get meat. And I'm like, oh, I kind of love that this film doesn't shy away from like emphasizing what a like local radio station in a community like that would be. Like,
yeah.
Especially in that era, like radio was still so important in the 80s, like, and even into the 90s a little bit. And I just love that we got that too, in addition to being like the airing of the grisly murder live on the air.
Yeah. And I think that there's a little bit of hesitance on Chop Top's part to do what he has to do. And I think that's why he doesn't double check Leatherface's work, because they gleefully kill LG. They don't give a shit about
LG.
Oh,
yeah, no.
But Leatherface spends a lot of time terrorizing Stretch, but he doesn't ultimately hurt her. Like,
right.
He gets very, very close to hurting her. And then you see, like, this sort of perverted, like, psychosexual thing that Leatherface has with his chainsaw. So, mm-hmm. like, I think that that's a pretty clear parallel there.
Yeah.
But he doesn't ultimately kill her. He just, like, you know, destroys her station, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really interesting aspect to this, is that obviously our story wouldn't continue had Stretch died at that point. But we have this really compelling story where Stretch is attached to Leatherface because she wants to stop him on her side. But Leatherface also cares about her.
Yeah.
In a gross, icky way. And then there are like some caring sequences later on, like when he puts LG's face on her face and then dances with her. Like, ew. But also like he's trying to show like, I want to protect you, like I care about you. He doesn't ultimately like immediately kill her when Drayton like tells him to, or when Grandpa comes out, like he is still kind of hesitating. He's like trying to kiss her, you know. It's an interesting kind of draw through that although Chop Top is brutal and doesn't really care later on, he's just kind of like, well, I got to do what I'm supposed to do. Leatherface, there's definitely some care there.
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing, because in the first movie, you don't really see that so much. It's more just like that mindless killing machine. And in this one, we get, oh, he actually has like feelings and thoughts.
Well, and that's something that the remakes, the subsequent sequels, the reimaginings, I wrote a note that actually, you know, for as convoluted as the Halloween timeline is, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre timeline is even worse. But the subsequent films after this really do start to explore that in different ways. Like, is Leatherface a reluctant killer who is, you know, just sort of doing his family's wishes, you know, and is coerced because of some neurodivergence? Is he, you know, they subsequent films do kind of explore that. I don't know that any of them ever get it right, but I think that this movie definitely triggered more people to sort of look at Leatherface the character and say, oh, what if there is more nuance there than just the chainsaw wielding killer that we see in the first movie?
Yeah, I think Rob Zombie sort of takes that and says the quiet part out loud in House of a Thousand Corpses, where he's like, no, this person, you know, does have mental problems, and the family has coerced them into being the killer.
Yeah.
Also not a huge fan of Rob Zombie movies, most of them, if not all of them. And I think that that is why, because the exploitation makes me feel really gross inside.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like this movie is exploitative necessarily of Leatherface specifically as a character. It feels more like they're all kind of living in this strange bubble.
Yeah.
That does not, it like runs adjacent to real life, but not ever touching it. So Leatherface gets to do his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And although he has to help in the ultimate work of the family, he's not being like, you know, beaten or coerced in that way.
Right.
Which I feel like is a pretty common theme in Rob Zombie's films. And I think that's why I don't like them.
Yeah. And some of the other sequels, prequels, remakes, prequels to sequels to remakes explore like a more coercive background, especially the ones that explore a younger Leatherface and his kind of coming up.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that this movie can almost exist outside of those too. Like, I'm sure that there are things that they take from this movie and then expound upon in later whatever revamps, reboots, requels, whatever the hell you want to call it. But I think that this movie could also exist outside of those and just be like, this is just a weird family that lives inside this strange, like, paper mache Battlefield Texas castle and in the, you know, several stories underground that they've carved into their home. But I like that.
It's funny because this one almost feels more like directly parallel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, you know, which is another one that people have historically had very mixed feelings about. You seem to either love it or hate it. It's either a gleeful part of canon, or it's a gleeful thing that gets set apart from canon, or it's trash, or it's whatever. But I feel like this one and that one are so parallel in a lot of regards, in just the kind of leaning into the absurdity, but also in the treatment of a lot of the characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that is one thing that I think the first one lacked. So I think that the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I'm going to talk about Lefty for a second.
Yeah.
I really like the character of Lefty because it sort of gives us a wraparound. Like, it gives us a drive to revisit this family, which otherwise we might not have, because without Lefty as a character, then Stretch would never have been, you know, never have been motivated to go after these people.
Right.
And she would never have made anybody listen to this, like, grisly, gruesome, awful death on the air. And that would never have called the family to her. And in the 70s, there was this, speaking specifically about the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then as a parallel to that, The Last House on the Left, the 70s version, the OG Wes Craven version, the stupid cop, the dumb, bumbling idiot, sheriff, whatever cop was a trope. And it's a trope that I hate. I hate that trope.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, in fact.
I think it pisses me off, especially in The Last House on the Left, because I think ultimately that movie is like extremely violent in a very personal way for me. And so the dumb cops that are like, we gotta steal this truck full of chickens, is like, pisses me off. So in this movie, to have a semi-intelligent but warped person, like person who has been changed by this search for these awful people, because in the original script he was supposed to be, he was going to be like Stretch's illegitimate father,
right?
But then ultimately he ends up being Sally's, I think, uncle. There's some like times that he mentions like, this was my brother's kids.
Yeah.
But then he refers to Franklin as his brother. So I don't know. He also just kind of like uses terms of endearment randomly. So
especially at the end.
Yeah.
He really just sails off the deep end with that.
Right. But I like his character because it's like, okay, we have a semi-intelligent law enforcement person, and he is our driving force, at least initially, to be a part of this story. And I like that. I liked that kind of turn away from the dumb, bumbling idiot cop. Although he does some weird stuff, like buying three chainsaws, and then like the weird chainsaw thing that he does when he's at the chainsaw store. That's kind of weird. And then like the strange like triple wielding harness thing that he has. It, all
singing
weird.
To him when he goes into the lair.
And, you know, Dennis Hopper said that he thinks this is his worst role alongside with Super Mario Brothers. But I think that this is kind of, it reminds me of a Coen Brother film. Like,
yeah,
his character reminds me of, it's like if No Country for Old Men met Fargo. So it was like sort of the bumbling idiot, but like, not. I don't know.
I can see that.
Maybe I'm not explaining it right, but I really liked his character in this because it was such a departure from the original film, where we have like a reason to revisit this. It's not just like, oh, we happened upon this randomly and then this family kills us and eats us and they're all gross and awful and terrible. It's like, no, we have a reason to visit this. And not only that, the family is actually interesting and they have a purpose.
Yeah.
So, you know, Drayton is, he runs a food truck and participates in chili competitions with his like, quote unquote, meat, the finest meat in Texas, he says. And I like that. I think that that draws you in. It gives you a reason. It's not just senseless killing. It's like, no, he's in pursuit of the best chili.
Yeah. If you want to take a real big, big analytical look at this film, the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre film was in part about Vietnam, in part about politics. In this one, they talk about the aftermath of Vietnam because Chop Top is supposed to be a Vietnam veteran,
mm-hmm.
Which is why presumably he was not in the first one.
Right.
Is that he was away, you know. Yeah.
Getting his medal.
Head. Yeah. Recovering elsewhere.
Yeah.
But this one, if you actually sort of isolate Drayton's part and like Drayton's dialogue, it's very, very interesting because it says a lot about like, here is a person through very twisted methods who is trying to take an industry that his family was in because the Sawyers were part of like the meatpacking business and the industry sort of failed, and they refer to that with the grandfather and they say, you know, it was like a failing industry. And one day he just stopped showing up.
Right.
Likely from depression, from, you know, economic factors. And then Drayton repeatedly, and oftentimes it's in very chaotic scenes, so you have to kind of know to listen to this, is like ranching about like taxes and how hard it is for the small businessman and stuff like that. So it's a really, really interesting juxtaposition to think like, wow, here's this person whose family is doing horrible, heinous things, and they have really questionable methods, but ultimately they're just trying to hustle.
<laughs> You know? Yeah,
they're trying to hustle with their food truck. I don't know,
right? Like in any other place that might be like moonshine, or you know, I don't know, what other things do people smuggle? Drugs, whatever.
Yeah.
It could be any of those things, but he, like, because this is sort of a parody of Motel Hell, they're like, no, let's make the dude like a cannibal.
Yeah.
And you know, he's making meat and he's got to make this chili. It's like world famous or Texas famous at this point.
It's also very Sweeney Todd-esque.
Oh yeah.
Like where he's feeding all these people human meat and they're like, oh, it's so delicious. You have to tell us your secret. And it's like, it's people.
Yeah. Soylent Green. I think that that is hilarious. I think that he is such an interesting character. And even when he's dying, even after Dennis Hopper like hit him in the ass / ball area with the chainsaw, he's like going on and on about it.
Yeah.
About how he's like, oh man, it looks real bad. And then he just keeps going on about how like it's always the little guy getting, you know, shafted.
Yep.
So really interesting. He's such an interesting character. And then Chop Top going on about Vietnam and then what he likes in terms of music and flashing the peace sign and wearing his Sonny Bono wig until it gets destroyed is fascinating, honestly. And even though this was made in 1986 and is definitely an 80s film based off of the music that we're hearing, Stretch play at the radio station, it is an interesting kind of conversation about a post-Vietnam world, especially in the middle of buttfuck nowhere in Texas. Like it really is a very interesting discussion about that. And I think that that's something that the first one lacked, although we can apply that sort of Vietnam parallel in what the world was like in the 70s. We can apply that. It's not really overt as it is in this film. Like just take a look at Chop Top's buttons on his, you know, on his vest that he wears when he comes in, and some of the music that he scoffs at and some of the music that he asks for. Like he says it wrong, but he asks for Inagata De Vita by Iron Butterfly, like the quintessential song from the Vietnam era, you know. It's a very interesting kind of compelling take on that. So I think that that like makes it sail way higher, even though we're brought back down to the goriness and the chainsaw killing and Dennis Hopper like slowly losing his mind and chopping down all of the wooden beams that are holding up this strange house / it's kind of like an anthill almost.
Yeah.
But I did also want to say that I think the set design is fantastic in this movie.
Oh my God. So, there are so many details, like really intentional details in the sets for this film. And I think that gets missed when you just look at it as like gory chaos, which it is. Like so gory, in fact, that they went with unrated because they were going to get an X rating. They could not get an R rating for this movie. So they just said it was unrated. And it was banned in a lot of countries for a long time.
That's funny, considering it was the 80s.
Oh, yeah. It took years and years for like New Zealand and a few other countries to get this film.
Wow.
But I think when you look beyond that, like, there are so many details, like all of the stuff in the radio station. The lair is like incredibly detailed. I feel like I see something new every time I watch it. Just something little where I'm like, oh, look at that. yeah, that's neat.
Yeah. Like, there's a part where Dennis Hopper is, he sees a skeleton in a wheelchair and he's like, Franklin? And maybe there are other clues that tell us that there's Franklin, but there are other people in this weird molehill that are in wheelchairs, like other skeletons, where it's like, how do you even know?
Yeah.
Like, you don't know that that's Franklin. He's just assuming that that's him because there's a wheelchair involved.
Right.
But yeah, like the chairs, the skeleton chair that stretches like handcuffed in when they bring the grandpa out, the grandpa's little like rickshaw thing that they roll him out on, the grandpa in general, like his makeup effects are great.
It's considered one of Savini's best makeup.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It looks incredible. Savini's effects in this are incredible.
Yeah.
Just in general. The dude's head like half cut off in the beginning and then it like sloughs off is amazing. But yeah, just the set design. I really, really, really liked the radio station. It feels like comfy, cozy, you know, like sort of goofy slapstick. But also their lair is amazing.
Yeah.
Like all of the Christmas lights, and he keeps talking about property taxes. Drayton keeps talking about property taxes. And I'm like, yeah, dude, you have to pay your property taxes because how much electricity are you using in this place? There's so many Christmas lights.
Yeah.
I really, really, really liked the lair and, you know, the slow destruction of the lair. So you get to see like all these different little parts where Dennis Hopper's like chopping everything down. It's really cool.
Yeah.
It was a really fun set, I bet.
Yeah. I loved the in the radio station where she's giving Chop Top the tour and she's like just grabbing things off the desk. She's like, this is an armadillo. This is Mr. Shark. This is some flowers. And I'm like, that's very accurate for a radio station that you would have just random nonsense on your front desk.
Yeah. I did wonder if a little bit of that was ad-libbed. Like,
I wonder.
She,
yeah.
She was just like having to pick up random shit and was just like, okay.
Yeah, this is what this is.
explain. I thought that that was great. And I don't know if this was actually filmed inside of a radio station. I would assume not because they destroy
windows. Yeah.
But it was really cool. Any movie that has a radio station, at least in part as one of the sets, is always like fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like Pontypool. Have you ever seen that one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That one has a really cool radio station, although like way more modern because I was like 20 years in the future when that movie was made. Good Morning Vietnam. I mean, to a certain aspect.
Like, The Fog.
Yeah. The Fog has a really cool one. I don't know. I'm always like, oh, that's cool. Because I also don't understand any of it. And I'm like, there's so many buttons. Every time I go in, I'm like, I'm definitely going to break something. So touch nothing.
See, I have the opposite thing. Like in A Quiet Place 2, the part of the radio station, I was like, that is not how you would do that. Wrong.
Yeah, I would be. I'm just like, I'm just happy to be here. I don't know how any of this shit works. I definitely have a set appreciation for this movie. It's really, really good. It's very well fleshed out. And
yeah.
I'm sure that that's because at this point, Tobe Hooper had his laurels, you know, like
totally.
He had some cash behind whatever it was that he wanted to make. So he's like, yeah, no, let's make the whole big underground weird thing. And you can see that how this inspired so many other movies that came after it.
Absolutely.
Like I mentioned Freaks before, like it's all over Freaks. Like,
yeah.
It almost could be made in the exact same weird molehill that Freaks was made. Like, I'm saying Freaks could have borrowed it.
Yeah. Yeah. The Sawyers moved out and the characters from Freaks moved in.
Yes. Like, Randy Quaid was like, all right, we're going to take this shit over. It absolutely could be that. But I was really appreciative of that. And Savini's effects, I think, were really, really good in this one, too. Like, better than they had any reason to be. I don't know. I think that it was, it's great. I loved it. I was going to ask you, so I haven't seen the third one. Do the characters of Lefty or Stretch ever come back?
Stretch kind of comes back. Stretch is actually in the third one. She is not named, but she is there as a reporter.
Okay.
And then she comes back in two other non-Texas Chainsaw movies. She's in Sharknado 4 as Stretch, though that is not considered like a canon appearance. Mm-hmm. But Caroline Williams is in one of the Hatchet movies.
Okay.
As a reporter. She's a different name, but she's definitely like a higher caliber reporter.
Okay.
And so Caroline Williams has said that she views that character as Stretch and that she, as she broke into a bigger market, would have changed her name.
Oh, fair.
You know, because Stretch is obviously like a real radio name. Her given name is supposed to be, I think it's Vanita, but definitely, like, if you're breaking into TV news, they probably would have made you change your name.
Right.
You know, you'd have an on-air name. And so Caroline Williams says that her appearance in the Hatchet films, that she feels like that character is Stretch just later in her career.
Oh, that's fair. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I definitely would have liked to see Stretch. And although maybe Lefty dies because of the whole grenade thing.
Yeah.
Like, we're left to assume that that happens, but we're not sure.
Yeah.
I did also want to say the ending is, like, so very Texas.
Yeah, I know.
it's a clear parallel to the end of the first one, where at the end of the first one, you know, Leatherface is, like, he's not really dancing around. He's, like, furiously slash maybe happily. There's arguments both ways, like swinging the big chainsaw around and yelling at the truck as it drives away. And in this one, it's Stretch doing that at the very tippy top of this weird molehill, and then there's like a ragged Texas flag like jutting out of one side of it, and it's very cool. It was a very cool ending. Very
it
like
is.
Yay, she made it.
Yeah. So very really celebratory of the final girl.
So next time we're going to do something totally different, because that's what we do on the show. We try to have a good mix. I think we do a good job of that.
Yeah.
So we're going to do something totally different like we do. We are going to go to 2022's Incantation, which is a Taiwanese horror film. Thanks to the pandemic, we had a lot of, I think, Southeast Asian horror films that kind of like were brought onto our radar that we didn't have otherwise. And so I'm excited. This is kind of a found footage-y movie, which, you know, I love found footage movies.
Oh, yeah, same. And I think, you know, it is very exciting that a lot of foreign horror that you would have to really like track down on the gray market or at conventions and really do the work to get is now way more accessible through streaming services. That's one of the good sides of streaming. So I'm excited that we have a lot to explore.
Yes, yes. And this one, although not, I wouldn't say the best among that year's horror movies, like in terms of top three, this is definitely a really scary one and a super strong contender for found footage horror movies, which can definitely be sort of played out.
Yeah.
depending on the subject matter, you know, like there's a kajillion Bigfoot movies and they're all on Tubi, if that tells you anything. So yeah, I'm excited for you to see this one.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch it.
Thanks for listening to Attack of the Final Girls. Find us online at attackofthefinalgirls.com.
And hear bonus episodes at patreon.com/attackofthefinalgirls. We're Attack of the Final Girls on Instagram and TikTok.
Our theme music is by House Ghost and is available on Rad Girlfriend Records.
Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode, and rate and review on Apple Podcasts so more people can find the show. I'm Juliet.
And I'm Teresa. Until next time, stay scary.